Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome, my friends, to Blog Talk Radio's Off the Shelf. We're switching it up just a little bit this week. Instead of Saturday morning, our usual Saturdays at 11, we're having our show today on Friday, October 15th at 9 p.m. I'm just a tad bit under the weather, but other than that, I feel absolutely fabulous. It looks like I'm trying to get a little cold. I want to thank you again for joining us here this evening. It's always a joy to have you here with us, and I'm excited and looking forward to this evening's show. I always learn so much from our guests here at Off the Shelf. For those who are tuning in for the first time, let me introduce myself. I'm your host, Denise Turney, coming to you live from the City of Brotherly Love, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. And I thank you for your support, and I encourage you not to let another day pass before you pick up a copy of Long Walk Up. Long Walk Up is a powerfully moving and inspirational book that you just will be delighted to add to your book collection. You can pick up a copy of Long Walk Up today by visiting www.chistell.com. You can also pick up a copy of Long Walk Up at Amazon.com, Barnes & Noble, Borders, Walmart, et cetera. If you don't see it on the shelf, just ask the clerk for it because it's carried by the largest book distributors in the world. And now let us go and meet our very special off-the-shelf guest. Our special guest today, she is a book author, a licensed marriage and family therapist, a talk show host, a wife, and a mother. She graduated from Duke University. She also attended the California Institute of Integral Studies, where she received a graduate degree in psychology. She is the author of the books The House, and I love the title of her books, The Road to, I hope I'm saying this right, Abaddon and Keeper of Secrets. She is online at www.anjulefloyd.com, and it's spelled A-N-J-U-E. L-L-E-F-L-O-Y-D. Again, that's AngelaFloyd.com. We are absolutely delighted to have her with us here this evening. Welcome, welcome to Off the Shelf, Angel.
Hi, how are you? Can you hear me now?
I can hear you. I can hear you. You sound a little faint, like you're far away a little bit, but hear you. You're coming.
Hold on one second. Is this better? Okay.
Yeah, that's a lot better.
Oh, wonderful. I had a headset on, and I was trying to see if which one was better, so I can go either way. Thank you so much for having me, and thank you for that wonderful introduction. It's always weird to hear what you've done being read by someone else.
when you hear yourself being introduced, there's so many questions that I want to ask you. First of all, I love your website. I love the design. It's just so attractive. It just pulled you in right away. So to start, I wanted to ask you, Andrew, who designed your website? I've gone to your website several times, and it's just very visually appealing. Did you design it yourself?
No, and I'm glad you did ask me, and you give me a chance to give credit where credit is due. Tyora Moody, she set up my website about 2 years ago. I did not know that she had done that. I had contracted someone else, and that person used her as their website designer. The person that I had contracted with was showing me how to actually blog. I did not know anything. And so her website designer at that time was Tyora. Since that time, Tyora now does all of that. And I'm going to have her on my show, Book Talk, Creativity, and Family Matters, tomorrow at 12 noon Pacific time, which is 3 p.m. Eastern time. So anyone that's interested in website set up and as a fiction author, Christian fiction author, please tune in. She's going to be my guest, and I'm going to have her talk about all that she does. She's really wonderful.
Yeah, I crossed paths with Tyora. Oh, my goodness. I think she's going to be on Off the Shelf in 2011, but I'm going back probably about 10 years. She is very good at what she does. She had a website years ago that more like a community site for women. But she is very good at what she does, and when you said her name, I could only smile. That said, do you recommend that other authors get a website, or you think just having a large offline presence is enough to really support a full-time writing career? Or do you think right now that authors should have some type of an online presence as well?
Well, that's a wonderful question. Thank you for asking it. Let me just say, for me, it is the only way that I could do what I'm doing. My first book, Keeper of Secrets, Translations of an Incident, was traditionally published in 2007 by a very small publishing house. I'm thoroughly thankful and will be forever for them giving me that first opportunity to get my book published. And also, there's a certain amount of accomplishment that goes along with that. They published the work they published was my MFA thesis. I have my MFA in creative writing. But the reality of it is I am not a very well-known author. I was not then. I hope I'm a little bit more well-known now, but when you're coming from the bottom, every inch counts. I think for someone like Dan Brown, someone like Janet Ivanovich, I don't know that they need a website, but, you know, all authors have them. But certainly people like myself and even mid-list authors that have been around for at least a decade or more are finding that, you know, the Internet is where everyone is at. It's not a matter to think of where you are in the field as much as it is where people are at. I have three daughters, ages 11 to 23. They spend more time either doing, you know, researching homework or just going online than they do television, and many of the magazines that they read are online. So I actually think that any author that's smart is definitely going to have some kind of Internet presence, because even if people see you on the television or hear your name on a traditional radio station, they're going to go back to their Internet and look to see who you are.
Yeah, no, I agree. That's a very good point you just made, and that's the first time I heard that. Even if you are well-known, people tend to Google things, and they want to find out more about even a well-known entertainer or writer. They'll go on the Internet and want to find that information, and I don't think it's good when people go on and they see that there's nothing there. They like to know that there's something. If you don't have a website that you do, either you know, Facebook or some kind of way you can be reached via the Internet.
Let me say something about the Internet,
kind of,
and I think a lot of people have the impression that they want to be that only, how can I say, I want to say this correctly, but that the Internet is kind of stepping down from mainline media sources as you and I. I mean, I'm 50 today. It's my birthday, so you know.
Happy birthday!
Thank you. I've been looking forward to this interview because it's going to be like my birthday interview. But I think a lot of people of our age group, and you're probably younger than I am, but you know, we're a lot of people of our age group tend to look at the Internet as a step down. But the reality of it is that the Internet is really where it's at. And I'll tell you why I think it's where it's at. As a therapist and a person who likes to observe behavior, I look at myself. First of all, we're very busy. We don't have a lot of time, none of us.
Mm-hmm.
And even when you're looking at television, it's a 15-minute soundbite. You don't have time to sit there and read it and think about it, and you know we talk about multitasking, but you know, I can be writing something and listening to a Blog Talk Radio show, and that Blog Talk Radio show will inform me if I happen to be writing on the same subject. You know, television is a one-way communication, but the Internet is interactive. It actually is very respectful of people's intelligence.
Yes,
so anyone that's in business and that doesn't respect the fact that human beings want to get to know you and they like to do it in a way where they can take their time doing it, I think they may want to rethink their perspective.
Okay. Very good point. It is interactive, and television, a lot of television shows are trying to become that way. That's it. I wanted to ask you next. Because you work in a field that a lot of people are afraid of. If you tell a lot of folks you're a psychologist, they're like, whoa. Like, they don't want, they almost like you're studying their body language or what they're saying, and you've done this analysis on them already, and you guys have just, you've just met, and they're not a client. A lot of people, I think, can be a little afraid when they hear that somebody has a psychology degree or has studied in it. That's it. I wanted to ask you, how did you get from psychology to writing, or did writing come first?
Well, your questions are very – I love these questions. I mean, you're a great interviewer. Let me first go back and say that in my opinion, whether therapists, psychologists, those with master's degrees and PhDs, or psychiatrists or social workers, or any of those of us in the mental health field, whether we will tell you this or not, I'm going to let you know, and those listening, that we come to this because we need to do our own healing. And we come to this because we are broken. And we are conscious of our brokenness, and we have a way of dealing with our brokenness that allows us to assist others in becoming comfortable with their own brokenness. Now, I want to say that again. We are all broken that come to this, but all people have some kind of heartbreak. But I think what separates the good ones from those who aren't so good and other people who choose not to go into to become a therapist, but still they have their own human heartbreak, is that we have a way of working with our own brokenness that allows us to assist others in their brokenness. And I think that's how I look at it. The second thing is, I'm sorry, go on. I didn't mean to interrupt you. Go on.
No. Go ahead. Go right ahead.
What I was also going to say is how I got to writing is, you know, therapy is nothing more than, and I say this, you know, I'm not trying to belittle it because it's a very sacred work we do. And what I'm talking about is allowing other people a space to come in and share their stories with you. I mean, that is such a healing moment for me. No, I don't talk about my life in therapy. There are times when I think it might be appropriate to let my client know something about me that will support them in their healing. But it is a real blessing, and I accept it with much grace when people trust me enough to come in and tell me things that they may never have told anyone. So, you're listening to stories, and no, I don't write about my clients. What I do use my work with clients to do is help me to write about myself in a way in stories. And I'm not, you know, everything is autobiographical. I don't write memoir, but the reality of it is you know this as a writer, anything we write, it comes from within us. And so writing is just a natural outgrowth, although I was writing before, but I think it was after I got my MA in psychology, I got back into writing. And if anyone wants to read that long story, go to Facebook, go to MySpace. You can read how I got into writing fiction.
Okay. I wanted to ask you next. I find this interesting, and I'm sure that many women, or I would imagine that many women might also. Why did you choose to focus on, in your writing, why did you choose to focus on a mother-daughter relationship and as a therapist and as a writer? And how do those relationships weave themselves into the stories that you create?
Well, you just made it so easy for me. I had a very strained relationship with my mother. I loved her dearly. I was brought up in the South. You know, I'm African-American, and I think after Jesus Christ comes our mothers, you know. You can do a lot of things in the African-American community, but you don't talk about mama. And and that's a good thing. That's a good thing. I like that we have that because the Eurocentric American culture doesn't seem to have a lot of respect for anything. But that being said, mothers, and I am a mother as well as being a daughter, as well as being a wife, mothers are not perfect. I can say that because I am a mother and I make many mistakes, and I have made mistakes, and I will continue, despite trying not to, I will continue to make mistakes. I have three daughters, ages 23, 18, and 11, and one of the things that I have learned is that children, particularly daughters, they need to be given room, not to disrespect you, but they need to be given room to fight with you in the sense that they need to be able to battle. They need to be able to use the relationship, the crucible of relationship between mother and daughter needs to be big enough to let that daughter have her anger with you around things where she disagrees with you and you still love her. Now, to be able to do that.
Now, I don't have a daughter. My sister, I don't have a daughter. My sister has a daughter, and she said, well, they might be listening. I don't have a daughter, but I know women who do, and they say something happens to their daughter when the daughter turns 12. It's like they don't even know what happened. It's like somebody else came into the house.
Well, let me just say, I've done that for two daughters, you know, and I'm blessed enough that my 23-year-old, after 4 years of college and 1 year of graduate school, before she started law school, asked if she could move back home. And that really thrilled me, because it said to me that I had done something right, in that we could be friends, best friends, now that she's an adult. I'm still the one that she says I'm her best friend, but, you know, I'm still the one who has a little bit more experience, but I can tell you, she teaches me a lot. My younger is going to be 12 next year, so I'm approaching that transformative period. So I can definitely agree with what, you know, I know what your sister's talking about, but the way I like to reframe that is, I don't know that something happens at 12 with the daughter. What I think happens is that two things: ancestral injuries that have not been dealt with, I think, make themselves, their presence known in this child when they turn 12. You know, there's a reason that the Bible talks about 12 years old. There's a reason that in Judaism you have the bar mitzvah. You know, 12 is a year before the onset of menses. It's just 2-3 years away from, you know, adolescence. It's an important time. And I think the consciousness of a child, particularly a girl, expands to a point where things that have not been dealt with, they manifest their presence in that lineage. I think another thing that happens, we as the mother witness our daughter, her breasts kind of plumping up. There's a physical change. You know, my little one is not my little one anymore. And I think there are things go on in both of us, and what I like to say is that if you haven't, as a mother, and the same thing goes on with fathers, with their sons, if you haven't, as a mother, dealt with done your own inner work, you know, that's where you get a little uncomfortable, because, hey, that daughter is going to soon be a place where she can get pregnant. If you've got issues around what happened with you in high school and you haven't dealt with it, you're going to be concerned.
Yeah.
Not because your daughter's intimating it, but because you have not done your inner work.
Yes.
So what I suggest to people is, and that's the reason, I'll just be blunt, you know, my relationship with my mother was very strained. But I went into therapy, and I think I had an inclination, because it's just me and my personality, but I went into therapy with the understanding in myself that I did not want to perpetrate what had been going on with her, and I'm sure was going on before her. I wanted to take the good things that she gave me and sift out the things that weren't so helpful, so that when my daughters came along, I could avert the hurt and pain that I saw her go through when she was dying. And I can talk about that a little later. I don't want to take over your show, but, you know, if you work your way around it, I can give a little hint around why we as women who are mothers and wives need to do that work. We don't do it. For me, I said I was doing it for my daughters. By the time my oldest daughter reached adulthood, in between that time my mother died, and now because my daughter's an adult and I can now see clearer where my mother probably was when I was in college, I now understand, yes, I'm doing it for my daughters, but really I was doing it for me.
I would say any type of therapy would be, you know, you might say you're doing it for, and you might sincerely be doing it for others, but also, of course, for yourself. Can you tell our off-the-shelf listeners about your book, The House? What a intriguing title. What is the key message in your book, The House?
Well, the key message I'm actually grabbing the book right now. The key message in the House, and it kind of segues right into what you were talking about, is that, you know, all of us hold regret. and we're seeking forgiveness. But our salvation rests in the hands of others, most particularly the ones we love the most, and of those people, the ones who have hurt us the most.
Mm.
We have to learn to forgive, and that's a hard
right.
thing to do. But if we don't forgive, we pretty much guarantee ourselves not getting salvation.
Mm.
We're not forgiving that person for them. We're forgiving them for us because they hold the keys to our salvation. That doesn't mean that they didn't mistreat us. That doesn't mean that they've got to deal with that themselves. But if we can't forgive the person who has hurt us and the person who has hurt us and that we love, we are sealing ourselves away from salvation.
Mm. Yeah, forgiveness is that's a big topic, and it does. I think it's very freeing to the person who does forgive. I think it is very, very freeing. And you can think you've forgiven, but if something still triggers you, then there's still work yet to do. And sometimes it can take years, or like a baby walking. If you're ready, it can happen very, very quickly. I wanted to ask you if you work with clients before who experienced what happened in the house, and do you find that they forgive in their own real life situations despite having endured years of abuse and pain?
Well, you know, I'm gonna do something very different than I've ever done before. I'm gonna talk about where I think the house came from. I can first say that
okay.
I have not been through divorce. I know some people who have been through divorce, but to be honest with you, I haven't really. I mean, I'm sure there are many listeners that have been through divorce or either watched someone go through divorce at a much more intimate distance or proximity than I have had. What I do know is what it was like to be abused emotionally and physically by my mother, who was also an extremely good provider, a very decent and hardworking Christian woman that wanted nothing but the best for me. I know that. But at the same time, she could be treacherous. And I know that. And I know that there are people, particularly in the African American community, that knows that you know what I'm talking about, women. We know how mothers can be. And they went through a lot, and you know, our people have been through a lot, and so our survival is certainly a celebration. But in the midst of the survival, there have been some things that have taken place and that still take place. I can say as a mother, I see some things take place that are horrible and horrific. But I also know that the people committing those abuses upon their children, not to sidestep it, and let me just say, my mother never molested me or anything like that. She was just physically and emotionally abusive and very distant and demanding and wanting me to be the best. And I know that she was doing that from a place of pain. How do I know that? Because in becoming a mother, and becoming a wife and then a mother, I got to step into some shoes that were lateral to her. And I got to see what I had, where I came from. And also, I'm going to say this too. As a therapist, we say this in the field. Many of us say that we don't choose our clients. They choose us. And ultimately, the universe brings certain clients to us because they know that we are better suited to help them. And they have a lesson to teach us, which we gain by helping them. I've had a number of clients that, when I really began to look at it, were probably versions of my mother, or they carried hurt my mother. And looking at them, I could go, oh, was that maybe what she was dealing with?
Wow.
I'll never really know what was going on with her. I don't know if you've read The House, but, you know, Edward is not, you know, he's the adulterer, philandering husband. He's a good provider. He's an excellent father. He leaves a lot to be desired when it comes to being a lover. But at the same time, in the story, we don't really get into Edward. We get into Anna. So Edward is part of the half-known world, and I think we all can relate on some level. If it's only the bully that we met in the fifth grade that was just terrible to us, we don't know why they did what they did, but if we give ourselves time, maybe 20, 30, 40 years later, when our children are in school and dealing with the bully, and yet we're the adult and get to see what that bully's parents may be doing or where that then we get to think, oh, could that have been some of what was going on with the person in my life?
Right. Wow. Very, very interesting. And I like how your work is sort of an extension. I don't know if you intend for it to be, but it seems like an extension even of your therapy. I absolutely love the trailer at your website for the house. And I got to ask you, did you create the trailer? The music that accompanied the trailer is so fitting.
That trailer I created it probably a year and a half ago. I found out about Animoto through one of the Ning sites I belong to. Someone said, hey, if you need to make a video, a book trailer, you can do it free at Animoto. So I went there, and I had the images. I think I got the images from Flickr or either from iStock Photo, very, very reasonably priced, maybe $10 if I spent that. I have to give credit again where credit is due. The music was free because, of course, when you start using music for something like this, you have to have copyright for your music. So Animoto provided that music. And, of course, I play piano and I love classical music, so it was an easy choice for me. But when it comes down to the editing, my then 16-year-old, who is now a high school senior, did that for me. My first cut of that was much too long. As you know, book trailers should be no more than a minute, at the most a minute and 20 seconds. My then-year-old sat down. She said, oh, Mommy, this is too long. And she sat down, and she did her thing, and that's what you have. So she did that.
Oh, my goodness. Hats off to her and to all the folks in you for finding it and helping everything coming together the way it did. For our off-the-shelf listeners, I just want to read a little bit of this as you all listen. This start is just fabulous. You've done more than anyone can. We need to get those two individuals off that flight. I spoke with her husband tonight. No, Ray said, amid the descending fog. Those words between her husband and the U.S. Senator set Lonnie in motion to uncover who is on what flight. When plane and airline bombings are the order of the day, what she learns both terrifies and frees her. Off-the-shelf listeners, that's the opening, and I could have read it better, but some of the words I wasn't certain about. For Angela's book, The Road to Ibadan, please correct me if I'm
wrong. The Road to Ibadan.
Ibadan, what an opening. When I read that, I was like, wow. Is this book a mystery or a thriller? I'm thinking it's got to be one of those two.
Well, I would say it's a suspense thriller. I hesitate to say thriller because all of my novels are really internal novels, in the sense that they are about they're character driven novels. Let me just say that it was interesting to hear you read that because first of all I wrote that book back in 2001 and I actually got the copyright. Well, no. You're very interested in this book, and see, I haven't even really edited that book in the sense that I worked on it, but I did all that work before I got my MFA in creative writing. I was not nearly as skilled as I am now, and I'm still learning an awful lot. I put The Road to Ibadan on Smashwords as kind of a test thing to see if I could actually go through the motions correctly of putting things on Smashwords. It is a book that I will go back and certainly edit now and get it ready for publication because you've just told me, which is what's so great about hearing people talk about your work, you've told me that, hey, it's not as bad as you thought it was. I mean, it still needs work.
I thought it was a fabulous opening. Oh, my goodness. I was just getting ready to say, you are very good at writing hooks because I've read the intro to some of your other work, and you pull readers in. And this, they say this about writers, you know, don't take so long to just get right to the story. You are very good at writing hooks and pulling readers in. I mean, right away, you waste no time. I wanted to ask you, did this skill come over time, you know, years and years of writing, or have you always noticed that you had this, since you started writing novels, you just get right to the point right away? You don't waste not one word.
One thing I will say is that I believe that that is definitely a skill I have developed over time. What's amazing is that you felt pulled into that story that wrote to Ibadan, which I wrote. That was actually my second story that I wrote. That was a story that when I wrote it in 2 weeks, I wrote it in 2 weeks in the summer of 2000, and then by 9/11, my husband woke me up and said, you know, your story's kind of happened in real life. And that's
wow.
When it hit that, you know, maybe something was I was channeling something. But, you know, back in that time, because I graduated with my MFA in creative writing in 2007, one of my major problems was not so much character, but starting the story off and then kind of getting into character and not getting back into the plot. You know, part of writing good tantalizing fiction is giving enough character to sustain the front story, which is essentially the plot. And plot has always been my major issue. Plot has always been my major issue, and that is the part that I've had to learn over time. I'm sure that if you, I hesitate to say this, but I'm sure that if you read The Road to Ibadan, if you read it, you probably would find that I would kind of get away from that opening and kind of get too much into character, which is what I learned not to do in my MFA program. And the way I did that was by working on short stories. The first four short stories in Keeper of Secrets, which is my collection of short stories, actually came out of novels I had written prior to entering my program. Yes, and the namesake story of Keeper of Secrets, which is Keeper of Secrets, comes out of The Road to Ibadan. And so what I did was I used those novels as a launching pad because, again, writing a story, whether it be a short story or a novel, is about character and plot. And I am one of those people that believes that plot flows out of character. So I said, okay, these four novels, I know the characters, so I can just focus on plot, and that is what I did. So, you know, you can get a little peek into, for those of you that are listening, you can get a little peek into Lonnie's life if you purchase Keeper of Secrets, Translations of an Incident, and read the second story. Just like the opening story comes out of a novel that I wrote called Absalom. So that's kind of how I, over time is my roundabout way of saying that's how I kind of learned to do that.
Okay, and I love that your website where for our off-the-shelf listeners, Andrew, she gives you so many different ways that you can purchase a book. You can either get an e-book or some of the formats, including HTML, Kindle, PDF, Palm, plain text, or EPUB. I just thought that was really, really smart of you to give readers so many different options to actually get the books that you write yourself. And I love your blogs. I want to talk about your blogs next. You also blog, and I enjoy reading your blog, and I read a couple of your blogs about the contract negotiations under Writing Life. You've got these different Andrew has these different categories for off-the-shelf listeners at her blog, and one of them is called Writing Life. And I want to just ask you, what do you think is most important, focusing on putting out enough books to fulfill contract demands? Like a book, they say you got to do, and I know some writers who are just, they have so many books they have to get out in 1 year, I don't know how they do it. Or writing mainly to give readers number one, either focusing on writing enough books to fulfill contract demands, or writing mainly to give readers what you think they want, or third, writing simply because writing stories simply as a writer that you absolutely love without any thought of the reader or any thought of the contract. Which do you think is most important in regards to growing a professional writing career?
Well,
which of those three approaches?
You're very on top of what's going on in publishing, and I can tell that by your questions, and thank you for that question. Let me just say that, first of all, when you get into a contract, you have signed a contract, and you've got to honor that. And if you don't honor it, you're going to be in trouble, and that's not right. I mean, you've got to honor the contract. What I would like to say is, for me, I would rather never publish a book if I can't publish it, if I can't give my personal best. What I also say is that we are now at a time in America and the world where internet and computer technology has made it possible for you to literally take a document, a PDF document, and have a book printed up in less than 30 minutes. Here in San Francisco, we have what they call book espresso machines, and they can print and bind a book in less than 30 minutes. But the flip side of that is that the imagination, the human imagination, does not work like clockwork. And likewise, because of the internet and so many people being able to get online and read so many things, I actually believe that writers who were never stupid and have always been very intelligent have become even more keen to good writing and what good writing is not. And they can pick out when a story is not taking them someplace. That being said, I think that it is imperative for writers, before they enter into contracts, to get it very clear within themselves what their lifestyle is going to lend them to do. First of all, let me just say, for me personally, I write a book every year. I've done that pretty much for the last decade. I did it before, and I didn't do it the years I was in my graduate program because I was doing other things writing there, but I write a book every year. And I let that book lay, and then I go back and work on a book that was laying from the year prior. That's how long it takes me to write a book. And even when I go back to revise that book, it will probably take me 18 months to 2 years to do the revision. I imagine that at some point I will shorten that time and become more efficient, but I will. I don't think I'm going to ever give up my habit of letting a book lay a year after and the reason I'm going to do that is because for me, I really am saying this for me, it is important that I know that I gave my personal best. I would rather not have a out there than to have one out there that when I look at it, I go, ooh, if I'd have taken more time. Let me tell you why I say that. First of all, I don't care who the publishing company is, your name's on that book.
Yes.
People are not going to say, how many times do you hear people say, well, I don't know why Random House put that book out. It wasn't good. What we do say is, I don't know why author so-and-so didn't have them do a job at editing. Mm-hmm. Well, guess what? Author so-and-so didn't really have a lot of control over the editing department. Right now, it is very difficult to get an editor when you are when you're in contract with a publishing company. Very few of the authors now get editors. Most people
you get your own. Yeah.
You have to get your own editor. And so you do that and at the same time they want you to have 2 and 3 books out a year, which I can't
right.
do. That's what they want, and I think there's a whole American phenomenon that's going on, not just in publishing, because I don't want to malign writers, but I think there's a whole phenomenon of immediacy that I don't know is very good for us. But that's what goes on there. So I actually think that the latter two that you're talking about are important. I think that, again, you need to be careful about whatever contract you get into. I think authors have to decide what their lifestyle can lend them. I have 3 children. And I chose to have 3 children. I'm married. I have a certain lifestyle. I'm not a full-time I'm a full-time mom. Writing is a part of my own healing and my own artistry. And I know what I can and cannot do. I don't think I could put out even a book a year. I'll be quite honest about that. I don't think I could do that even if I was on contract. Other people, they have a lifestyle that allows them to do. I will also say that I think that one of the best things anyone can do regards to promotion is to take time and write your book. I'll just tell you, The House came out because it's a self-published book, but it's self-published because my husband read it last year. Well, not really last year. He read it 2 years ago, and it was during the recession of the crash of 2008. And he said, and my husband's a very impatient person, and he read this, and he said, this is a good book. He said, it kept moving. And I said, yeah. And he said, well, I think it needs to be out there and published. And I said, well, haven't you been paying attention to the economic forecast? I said, you know, publishing has been well before, and it's certainly not doing well now. I said, and I was tongue-in-cheek. I said, only way this book's going to get published is if I self-publish it. Because I told him, I said, I'm not sending out a manuscript to agents and publishers. I'm not wasting that kind of money and time when I know that they're going to be cutting back. And I said, you know, the only way it's going to get out there is if I self-publish. He said, look, I want to self-publish. And I was totally shocked. And that's when that's when the gift horse was sitting there, standing there for me. And so that's when I started blogging. Okay. That's how my website got set up, because I knew that if I did that, I was going to have to promote it myself. Well, guess what? If you're traditionally published, you got to do your promotions anyway.
Yeah.
So it's one or the other. And I did that, and I can say that now, coming to the end of that process of getting The House out, I'm totally shocked at what I've been able to do. I'm very happy with what I was able to do. I'm sure that when readers read it, they will find some typos. Nothing is perfect as much as I would like it to be. But what I have learned is my process and what I can sleep with and what I can live with. And I like what Toni Morrison said. She said she wrote her first book so she could sit down and read it. Nothing would hurt me more than to write a book, put it out there, and then go back and read it, which is what a lot of folk do. They put the book out, and then they go back and read it, and they're very disturbed with what they read. You cannot promote a book that you are not thoroughly in love with, and you only fall in love with the book that you have given your personal best to.
Yes. No, I agreed. I want to ask you next. And as you said, and as the last guest that we had on, Dallas Woodburn, said the same thing, that as much as you try to leave parts of yourself out of your stories, when you go back and, as you just talked about, rereading your story, you find little things and you're like, I purposely intended not to put myself in here anywhere. And how did this get in here? So you're the artist, the work is coming from inside of you. I wanted to ask you, are there parts of you and the character Raven Clark in your book, Keeper of Secrets? And I asked this because as I was doing a research for this interview, I said, that's interesting. The character is a psychotherapist and a mother of three. So are parts from your own life or experiences or feelings about certain things, are they in Raven Clark?
Well, I can say that I haven't had an abortion. I have to be honest about that because let me just say why I'm saying that. I'm not saying that put down people who've had an abortion. Let me just say I am saying this because I read a story. This is a story someplace else that I was at a writing conference, and there was a share time where we could all read. And I read a short story, a very short story, like, you know, 1,500 words or less. And later on, a person came up to me and said, oh, I thought I was the only one that had been through that, and I didn't know what to say, and so I didn't say anything. So let me just say, I have not been through an abortion like Raven, and so I want it's not memoir. I want people to know that. I think it's important to be really clear about that. At the same time, I do have three children. I do have three daughters. I do live in the San Francisco Bay Area. I live in Oakland. Raven lives in Oakland. Most of my characters live in Oakland. I'm determined to let people know that Oakland is not just a place of drugs and violence, that we have wonderful parts of Oakland that are wonderful to live in and very safe to live in. And so Raven, you know, like Raven, I live in Oakland. And again, I'm going to do something. You know, you're a wonderful interviewer. I feel very comfortable with you.
Oh, thank you.
I have not had a lover. like Raven, but I did earn my master's in psychology from the California Institute of Integral Studies in the city, which was in the Haight at that time. It is now on the Mission now, but on Mission Street. And I did have a very close friend who, like Absalom, had traveled as a CEO of a large electronics company. And what I can tell you is that when you at CIS, a lot of the work that we did in our 3 to 4 years there, and we were adults, you know, we hadn't just come out of college. A lot of the work in becoming therapists is using each other as both client and therapist. And so we get to learn from each other. We get to hear about the times that this happened or that happened. And I did have a friend that was a man who, as I said, was a former CEO who had made the transition from heading up a huge electronics company to doing, you know, work in therapy. And his goal was to set up an ashram in India. And so coupled with that, I had traveled to India in 1989 with my husband, who did surgery there for 6 weeks. I had gotten a chance to go to Rajasthan. And so, you know, yes, I am in that. It is a lot of me, but it is a lot of it is. I think the story takes on a life of its own when it really sinks into Raven's dilemma.
Okay, for our off the shelf listeners, we're speaking with Angel Floyd. She's a licensed marriage therapist and counselor, and she is the author of the books The House, The Road to Ibadan, and Keeper of Secrets. And for our listeners, Keeper of Secrets begins, and this one was waste no words. It begins, Raven stifled a yawn as she stared at the wooden icon of Siva. Another night had passed with her being awakened by the wails of her four-month-old daughter, Karen. Raven had gone to Karen's bed, taken her from the crib, and cradling the infant lay down in the bed of the guest room. It had been this way nearly every night since Karen's birth. Karen never cried during the day. I mean, they probably want me to keep on reading. You just right away, you just don't mince words. I wanted to ask you, because I was so intrigued just by reading that. When I read it, I'm like, okay. Right away, you like gripped me, and I wanted to know, why does Karen only cry at night? And is the reason that she only cries at night, is it a key to what happens later in the book? Is the reason the little girl only cries at night, is it a key to the entire story?
Yes, it is. It's a call to a heart. It's calling the reader to notice what's out of place in this story. And let me, if you will, I'm going to point out why we need to take time to write our stories. And I'm going to say, first of all, as I said, that short story comes out of the novel that I wrote in 2002 called Absalom, and I've yet to get it ready for publication. When you read it, and you read very well, when you read it, I heard it as if I had not heard it before. And I heard new things in it. And what I heard was what was out of place. And what was out of place was the icon of dancing Shiva, the goddess, or the god Shiva, who's the god of death. The Hindu myth behind Shiva is that Shiva only dances when Shiva is angry. And Shiva's consort is Ma Kali, and blood drips from her lips. And as with, you know, the Hindu goddesses, they are not so much deities in the sense that they rule over us, but they're deities that reflect different aspects of ourselves. So Shiva is that part of us that is what we might in America call our righteous anger. And so seeing is that this deity that was given to her by Absalom, and it was carved by Absalom's father, who was Ugandan from the Ruwenzori Mountains, and there's a whole history behind that, because if you know anything about Uganda, you know that there's been strife, or there was strife and division between the native Ugandans who were of African ancestry or were Africans, Native Africans, and many of the South Asians from India that had settled there. I also learned during that research that part of Gandhi's ashes is in Kinshasa. So he had carved this, you know, this deity out of wood for Absalom's mother. His father had done that, and then Absalom gives it to Raven, the central character. She wakes up, she finds that it's gone. That's out of place. And then we find out what's also out of place is that she's given birth to what she has determined, she and her husband, Drew, has determined is their last child, will be their last child. Child is crying. Well, this child is crying because it is Corinne is 16 weeks old, and at the outset of Corinne's marriage, she had a 5-month abortion.
Okay.
I mean, for those of us that have had children, when your child is, when your fetus is 5 months, you feel the heartbeat. And she was also 2 months into her marriage with Drew, and that baby was the baby she had conceived with Absalom. And if you do the math, what you figure out is that she got pregnant by Absalom, with whom she had lived while she was engaged to Drew.
Very interesting.
And there's a lot more to that.
Oh my goodness! The way your story start off, and then the way you go in, and you just talk about it briefly, it makes you even still want to know. Okay, you gave a lot of information, but you still want to know how this story is going to unfold and how each little piece connects and makes the story whole. That even when you describe it, and definitely your intros. Oh my goodness! It makes somebody want to know. Okay, I gotta know why this little baby's crying and only cries at night. That you did a phenomenal job with that. I want to ask you, as we come down to the last 7 minutes of our interview, who are some of your favorite writers, and what is it about their work that you appreciate?
Oh well, I have to confess, I have a great love for South Asian writers. Jhumpa Lahiri, particularly Thridi Amargar, and my favorite book is A Sin of Color by Sunetra Gupta. These are all South Asian writers. I love their work because I love the emphasis on family in South Asian culture. And yet at the same time, I am reading about people that for all purposes, they look like me and you. You know, clearly they have a culture that is very different from America, but they are people of color. And one of the great gifts I have received from South Asian writers is, you know, unfortunately the legacy of the British has not been always wonderful for India, but one of the beautiful things that they left them with was the British love of language. And so for me to read South Asian writers, I have a person of color who is in love with books and writing and I mean literature. And at the same time is very astute to the relevant issues of today, of how we cross and mix old with new, east with west, inner and outer, at the same time holding on to what is true and dear and authentic.
Are you going to be appearing for our listeners who just itching to get to to perhaps meet you or have you sign one of your books or short stories? Are you going to be appearing at any book signings, writers' conferences, seminars, et cetera, et cetera? If so, can you give us a few dates for a few events that you're going to be attending and location and times so our off-the-shelf listeners who want to come out and support you can do so?
Well, what I can tell you is that right now I am totally on the Internet, but you ask a question at the most appropriate time. I will be doing a blog tour that is being coordinated by Tyra Moody, and that blog tour will be taking place every Monday throughout November. So anyone that is interested in participating in the November 2010 blog tour for me to promote the house, but of course I'll be talking about all my work and, you know, I'll be talking about questions and answering questions much like you've proposed, please go to my website, AngeuelleFloyd.com. That's A-N-J-U-E-L-L-E, Floyd, F-L-O-Y-D.com. And you can leave your email and let me know that you're interested in participating in the blog tour, and you'll get a chance to interact with me online. I hate to say this, but I live online. And so the best way to get in touch with me is through my website. I'm a busy mother and wife, but my family will tell you that if mom's not on the road driving and taking us someplace, she is at her computer. So that's the best way to get in touch with me.
Okay, and so all they have to do, there's someplace right there on the main website, is there, where it'll say blog tour, and you can...
Well, basically,
what you'll
need to do is to just, if you go to my website at the top right-hand corner, you can leave, I think there's a contact, let me just look very quickly. I'm sitting at my computer right now, so if you go to my website, AngeuelleFloyd.com, at the top left, right underneath my books, there's Join Mailing List. And
you can
do that, as well as the other thing you can do is you can contact Tyra Moody at Ty Webben, I think Ty Webben Creations, because she's actually...
Yeah, that sounds right.
Yeah, you can contact, because she's coordinating it. I'm saying this because I have to be honest, the blog tour filled out pretty much in the first week that she announced it.
Wow.
Yeah, it did, and I've been busy writing the blog specifically for that tour. I will be talking extensively about the characters in the house. I will be writing blogs on that. I also will have some blogs just on writing life, what it means for me to be a writer, as well as a wife and a mother. My husband is my muse, so there's, you know, there'll be stuff like that. But I think if you get in touch with Ty Webben Creations, she can give also people, listeners, she can give them the list of blog sites where they can go to that are going to be participating in the blog tour and where I will be doing guest blogs on those sites. I know Apu is one of those that I will be definitely going to. So anyone that is in contact with Apu, I will be there the first Mondays. Well, the Mondays, all the Mondays of November, I chose to do it that way because, again, I'm a wife and a mother. And also, I'm going to be giving away a Kindle as well for in a raffle.
Oh.
Wow.
Yeah. So I got to get over to your website.
Well, I have your email.
As soon as our interview is over, I got to get over there. And check out this blog tour. I have so enjoyed you. We have a minute left, and I just want to thank you for taking the time out of your day to be here with us and our listeners here at Off the Shelf. We have been interviewing Angela Floyd. She's online at www.angeuelleFloyd, AngeuelleFloyd.com. You can go over there and click on her. I forget what you said is the link where you can keep in touch with her, or shoot her an email, or Tyra Moody an email. You can Google her. Tyra will come up on the internet in a search, and you can get her email and just tell her you want to be a part of Angela Floyd's blog. It's going to be in November every Monday, where she'll go in more to her stories that are so incredibly intriguing. She seemed like a mystery writer of some sort, and a very good one at that. So I thank you again for being here with us. To our listeners, please tune in next Saturday. We'll be back on Saturday at 11 a.m. with another special guest, just like Andrew Floyd. And in closing, like I always tell you, remember that you're so loved, so truly valued, and so blessed. Go out and create a wonderful day for yourself tomorrow. Thank you, and bye for now. Andrew, I'll shoot you an email.
Oh, thank you so much. It was a wonderful
birthday.
Thank you. Take care.
All right,
bye.